Radio. Coming up is the news.
A Silicon Valley bank collapses amid anxiety over liquidity concerns, marking the second biggest bank failure in U.S. history. Anti-government protest rallies and job walkouts continue in France. Scuffles break out between police and demonstrators. And the BBC suspends its veteran presenter over criticism of the U.K. government refugee policy. And welcome from our headquarters in Tehran. Thank you for joining us. My name is Gisumisha Ahmadi, and these are our top stories this hour. The United States has suffered its second biggest bank collapse in the country's history. Silicon Valley Bank, the 16th largest bank in the U.S., failed after depositors hurried to withdraw money over concerns of a liquidity crisis. It was the second biggest bank failure after the collapse of Washington Mutual in 2008. Nearly half of the American technology and healthcare companies that went public last year after getting early funding from venture capital firms were Silicon Valley Bank customers. Moreover, a large number of startups will not be able to make payroll at some point next month if they cannot access their money. The bank was closed on Friday. Authorities say all insured depositors will have access to their deposits. However, nearly 90% of the bank's $175 billion in deposits are uninsured, and their fate hangs in the balance. Scuffles break out between French police and demonstrators who hit the streets to vent their anger at President Macron's unpopular pension reforms plan for a seventh consecutive day. Police used tear gas to disperse the crowds in Paris. Several trade unions marched through major streets of the capital. Similar demonstrations are also underway in other cities, with up to 1 million people expected to join. Total Energies says that it will keep up its strike together with other major oil refineries. Public railway operator SNCF is also striking. It has warned that services would remain heavily disrupted over the weekend. The preliminary text of the reform has already been approved by the Senate. The final draft is still under review, with a possible vote from the upper house of parliament slated for Sunday. Opinion polls show that a majority of voters oppose raising the retirement age from 62 to 64. Meanwhile, airport workers in Germany are also planning to strike at several airports to demand higher pay and improved working conditions. Verdi Labor Union has once again called on security personnel at Berlin, Hamburg, Hannover, and Bremen airports to go on warning work stoppages. The strikes will likely lead to processing delays and flight disruptions, including cancellations at the affected airports. This begins in early hours of March 13th. The unions demand that aviation workers be paid appropriately for working at inconvenient hours. The surcharges have not been improved since 2006, and a 10.5% increase in wages has been discussed since 2013. The employer's side has so far offered only a 5% raise for 2.5 million employees in the federal and public service nationwide. Now, two Italian freelance journalists have had their press accreditations withdrawn by Kiev last month while reporting for some Italian media in Ukraine. They were accused of collaborating with the enemy after having covered the Donbass war in the past years, and this is an accusation they completely consider unfounded.
After a year spent in Ukraine covering the ongoing conflict with Russia, Italian freelance journalists Andrea Ceresini and Alfredo Bosco returned to Italy a couple of weeks ago on advice of Italy's foreign ministry. The two had their press accreditation suspended by the Ukrainian authorities while they were returning from the Bakhmut front in early February. For weeks, they were unable to work, awaiting interrogation by the Ukrainian security service. Both journalists claim that Kiev's decision was unfounded.
Ukrainian authorities have never explained to us why our press accreditation was suspended. What we know is that both of us carried out independent reports in Ukraine and in the republics of Donetsk and Luhansk between 2014 and 2015. At least two other Italian journalists have received the same treatment. On our fixes chats, there were talks that we had been collaborating with the Russians, that we were spies. It would have been really dangerous to stay in Ukraine for us.
Some Italian media have reported that at least eight Italian journalists have been blacklisted by the Ukrainian Ministry of Defense over the past weeks. According to the two journalists, Ceresini and Bosco, all of them had reported from the Donbas region in previous years.
C'è rimasta un'esperienza un po' di delusione.
We thought a solution could have been found during Italy's Prime Minister Meloni visit to Kiev last month. We were ready to discuss our situation with the Ukrainian authorities. It goes without saying that we are disappointed.
Andrea Ceresini is an expert on far-right terrorism in Italy's 70s. He has been freelancing for a number of authoritative Italian broadcasters and newspapers from many areas of crisis, including Egypt and Venezuela. Alfredo Bosco established himself for his photo reportage on Mexico's drug cartels and 2010's Haiti's cholera outbreak.
Italy's Prime Minister Giorgia Meloni has yet to comment on the suspension of the two journalists' press accreditation by the Ukrainian authorities, nor has she ever expressed support for them. Rome has been a staunch supporter of Kyiv since the beginning of the war in Ukraine over a year ago. Max Civili, Rome.
Veteran BBC Sports presenter Gary Lineker has been suspended from his position over his criticism of the UK government's refugee policies. The state-funded broadcaster took the decision after government officials demanded action over the presenter's comments. Lineker, who's previously hosted refugees in his own home and has tweeted a video posted by the British Home Office announcing the government's Stop the Boats policy, has called the move beyond awful. Under its new policy, London would prevent asylum seekers from coming into the country, and it would instead deport them either back to their own country or to Rwanda. The decision against Lineker, who is also a former England football captain, has been met with widespread criticism. Outgoing Scottish First Minister Nicola Sturgeon described the move against Lineker as undermining free speech in the face of political pressure. And Iran has opened the mass production line for a new domestically developed training jet. The state-of-the-art jet dubbed Yasin would help trainee pilots get familiar with air combat tactics and techniques. Trainees will also learn the application of different kinds of weaponry on board. The training aircraft is capable of monitoring and recording flight data during and after the flight. It can show and analyze data in 3D format. Many of the systems installed on the aircraft have already passed standard tests. Some of them will go through final stages of testing during actual flights on the prototype before it goes into mass production. Iran has managed to domestically develop the training jet despite Western sanctions. And also, Tehran has finalized a deal to buy the Sukhoi Su-35 fighter jets from Russia. That, according to Iran's permanent mission to the United Nations, Tehran began approaching countries to buy fighter jets in order to replenish its air fleet. The deal was finalized after Moscow expressed readiness to sell the aircraft to Tehran. This following the expiration of United Nations restrictions on Iran's purchasing conventional weapons. The UN had retained an arms embargo on the Islamic Republic for 5 years since 2015, and that was when the world body endorsed the Iran nuclear deal, known as the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, or the JCPOA. Due to U.S. sanctions, the Iranian Air Force was struggling to acquire spare parts to keep its warplanes in the air. The Islamic Republic has managed to develop its own domestic aerospace industry despite such measures. And Iran and Saudi Arabia have agreed to resume diplomatic relations under an agreement mediated by China. This is what the Secretary of Iran's Supreme National Security Council said after days of intense negotiations with his Saudi counterpart in Beijing.
At the end of the talks, we reached a decision to start a new chapter after 7 years of severed relations between the Islamic Republic of Iran and Saudi Arabia, while considering the interests of the two countries, the security and well-being of the region, and preventing undue intervention from extra-regional forces, particularly from the West, and constant mischief by the Zionist regime in the region. We hope that this new chapter will compensate for the stagnation of relations over these last 7 years and also lead to stability and security in the region, as well as an improvement of the welfare of all its people.
Tehran and Riyadh will restore diplomatic ties in 2 months and reopen their embassies. Iran's foreign minister, Hossein Amir Abdollahian, says renewing ties offers great potential for the two countries, the region, and the Muslim world. China called the restoration of Iran-Saudi Arabia ties great news in the current turbulent world and a victory for dialogue and peace. The Saudi National Security Advisor has also welcomed the rapprochement.
The kingdom's leadership welcomes the initiative of His Excellency President Xi Jinping, based on the kingdom's consistent and continuous approach since its establishment in adhering to the principles of good neighborliness, taking everything that would enhance security and stability in the region and the world, and adopting the principle of dialogue and diplomacy to resolve differences.
Israeli officials have started blaming each other after Saudi Arabia's surprise move to restore ties with Iran. Opposition leader Yair Lapid said the agreement between Tehran and Riyadh reflects the complete failure of the new cabinet's foreign policy. Meanwhile, former Prime Minister Naftali Bennett has said that this will deliver a fatal blow to efforts to build a regional coalition against Iran. Bennett added that the resounding failure of far-right cabinets stems from a combination of political neglect with the regime's general weakness and conflict. But why has Saudi Arabia agreed to restore ties with Iran? Political analyst Said Mustafa Khoshchishb says Riyadh has realized that Washington is not a reliable partner given the fact that a new world order is being shaped.
Last fall, last autumn, when the rioting in Iran didn't end up in any good for them, now they have come to realize that they are faced with no other option but striking a deal with Iran and go for a resumption of ties. Second reason was exactly what you said, that after the U.S. pullout from Afghanistan and some other countries in the region, like what happened in Georgia, they have come up with this reality eventually that the U.S. is no good partner. The world is shifting. Even U.S. politicians, intellectuals in the West, in France and elsewhere, they've all been admitting that the future order will be determined by the Eastern power. And in the East, you will find China, Russia, Iran, India. Therefore, some of these countries in the Persian Gulf, the UAE, as well as the Saudis, they are revising, actually, or they are growing more cautious about their future and future ties.
A bomb blast in the northern Afghan province of Balkh has left one security guard dead and 8 people wounded, including children. The explosion occurred at an event for journalists in the city of Mazar-e-Sharif. Police say 5 journalists and 3 children are among the injured. While violence in general has fallen since the Taliban's takeover of the country, such deadly bombings are typically claimed by Daesh terrorists. The Iranian Foreign Ministry spokesman has condemned the terrorist attack, calling for more unity and awareness among Afghan people. The latest explosion comes just 2 days after a Daesh-claimed suicide bombing killed the governor of Balkh province. And that brings us to the end of this edition of World News. Stay tuned.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran.
The ocean of dua.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم الحمد لله رب العالمين ثم الصلاة والسلام على سيدنا محمد وآله الطاهرين. In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful. Hello everyone, brothers and sisters. I am Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi with you with another edition of the program The Ocean of Dua. During this month of Sha'ban, the month of Almighty Allah's mercy and pleasure, we will try to offer a glance into some of the passages of the whispered prayer of Sha'baniya, or the so-called Munajat Sha'baniya. Thank you in advance for staying with us. We'll be back again after listening to some parts of it.
Allahumma salli ala Muhammadin wa ali Muhammad. إلهي لم يكن لي حول فأنتقل به عن معصيتك إلا في وقت أيقظتني لمحبتك وكما أردت أن أكون كنت فشكرتك بإدخالي في كرمك ولتطهير قلبي من أوساخ الغفلة عنك.
Dear brothers and sisters, as you were previously with us, we were discussing this excerpt of the whispered prayer of Sha'baniya. إلهي لم يكن لي حول فأنتقل به عن معصيتك إلا في وقت أيقظتني لمحبتك. My Lord, I had no strength to desist from your disobedience except when you awakened me from your love. This love of the Almighty Allah is something that needs to be discussed further on. As you have been previously with us, we have had many episodes of the programs regarding this love throughout different occasions. But now, in this part of the whispered prayer, when Imam alayhi salam says that you have awakened me because of your love, as we explained in the previous episode, this kind of love is a kind of relative term that needs to be discussed further on. We have different levels of love.
We have those kinds of loves that are so superficial and weak that they are even unnoticed by the lover himself. And we have those other kinds of loves that the person who owns them is not even satisfied with the remembrance of the Almighty Allah. And among the more beautiful and more profound kind of love is what we find in the words of Amir al-Mu'mineen Ali ibn Abi Talib alayhi salam in the supplication of Kumail. He says, "Then suppose, O Allah, O my master, O my protector and my lord, that I am unable to endure your chastisement. How can I endure separation from you? And suppose that I am able to tolerate the heat of your fire. Then how can I endure not gazing upon your generosity? أَمْ كَيْفَ أَسْكُنُ فِي النَّارِ وَرَجَاءِ عَفْوُكَ. How can I dwell in the fire while my hope is your pardon?"
Alhamdulillah, we have been given the blessed opportunity of witnessing another month of Sha'ban, which is the month of Allah's mercy and pleasure. حَفَفْتَهُ بِالرَّحْمَةِ وَالرَّضْوَانِ. Allah has covered this month with His pleasure and mercy. I thought it might be good to have a little introduction to Munajat al-Sha'baniyya. The late Imam Khomeini in many places on several occasions emphasized on this Munajat. And in one of his sayings he said that there are many important mystical points that one can understand from the Quran and whispered prayers of Imams. And then in particular, he mentioned Munajat al-Sha'baniyya, and he said, philosophers, mystics may be able to understand some aspects of these whispered prayers. But if someone wants to really understand, must be a person who has himself achieved a high level of closeness to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala so that he can have a taste. He can have an experience of what he says. In another place, the late Imam Khomeini said something very important. He said, this Munajat al-Sha'baniyya is one of the whispered prayers that if someone pays attention to it and follows it and reflects on it, he can reach somewhere. He can achieve some levels of perfection. We ask Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala to forgive us in this month of forgiveness and to be pleased with us in this month of pleasure. We ask Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala to bless us, our families, our community, all humanity with His pleasure, with His reward, with the coming of Imam Mahdi ajjalallah ta'ala farajahu sharif, with forgiveness, with being able to remain always on the right path.
So this expression of love by Amir al-Mu'mineen Ali alayhi salam in the supplication of Kumail is among the most brilliant gestures of love, and it is actually the most sincere of it. Assume that a servant could endure the punishment of the fire of his master. How can he bear his separation and anger? A lover may tolerate the punishment of his master, but he cannot endure his anger and outrage, as he might bear the fire of hell, which is the most severe of the punishments. But he cannot bear separation from him. How can a servant be at rest amidst the fire of hell while he hopes that his master, his Allah, would turn to him favorably and rescue him from it? And this is of the magnificence of love we can discuss. So this is the kind of picture presented in this lofty supplication about love and hope. When it is said, إِلَهِ لَمْ يَكُنْ لِي حَوْلٌ فَأَنْتَقِلَ بِهِ مَعَنْ مَعْصِيَتِكَ Oh God, I had no strength to desist from your disobedience, إِلَّا فِي وَقْتٍ أَيْقَذْتَنِي لِمَحَبَّتِكَ When you awaken me because of your love, we understand, it is inferred, that any kind of action in my life is because of the love you have set in my heart. Any kind of obedience, any kind of remembrance, any kind of action is based upon your love. And you are the one who has set your love in my heart. So, a love above which there is no love is the one in which love and hope do not part the hearts of the servant, even when he is admitted to the punishment of his master. This is the kind of love that Imam Ali alayhi salam says, O Allah, if you even chastise me, if you punish me, I am unable to endure separation from you. This is that kind of love. Thank you, brothers and sisters, for staying with us in this episode. We ask the Almighty Allah to set us among the guided ones and the people of the straight path. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
شعبان بجمالك جلالك زهوبان والعالم يقلك أحبك يا شعبان شعبان بجمالك جلالك زهوبان شعبان بجمالك جلالك زهوبان والعالم يقلك أحبك يا شعبان والعالم يقلك أحبك يا شعبان يا شعبان أحبك يا شعبان
Hello, I'm Mubarak Kenya, and a big welcome to this week's edition of Africa Today.
Stay tuned with Africa Today.
Africa Today.
The United States is intensifying efforts to counter China's strong and positive presence in Africa. The U.S. is pursuing an anti-China narrative in Africa as an extension of its global confrontation with China. However, African officials insist that ties with China are beneficial to the continent.
I really appreciate this partnership, the growing partnership between the African Union and the government of China. And I had the pleasure to be responsible about the part of the partnership that relates to health and to social development. And in many areas in my portfolio, I came across a very recognized achievement between the two of us.
Hello, I'm Mubarak Kenya, and a warm welcome to Africa Today, a weekly program that gives you an alternative view of news and events making headlines in Africa. The first segment of our show today is focusing on the intense rivalry between the United States and China in Africa, which has its roots back to the Cold War. We're asking, why are African countries rejecting U.S. pressure and embracing China? In the second part of our show, we shall look at the Israeli regime's continued infiltration of Africa, this time through normalization of ties with Sudan. The people of Sudan have come out to condemn any normalization with the Israeli apartheid regime. So, will the regime in Khartoum listen to the masses? Stay with us for answers from our experts, and you can be part of this conversation by sending us your comments through our social media handle.
China-US face-off in Africa. Over the past few decades, China-Africa cooperation has met the urgent development needs of most African countries. Driven by the Belt and Road Initiative, China-Africa cooperation in infrastructure has seen a boost in critical transport infrastructure across the continent. On the other hand, in recent months, high-ranking U.S. officials have visited Africa, with Washington signaling its return to Africa with these trips. But what is the real intention of renewed U.S. interests in Africa? Is Washington really interested in the promotion of trade ties with Africa? Or are these visits an attempt to arm twist the continent to downgrade ties with China?
South Africa's International Relations Minister, Dr. Naledi Pandor, has expressed concern about the current tension between the US and China and its impact on Africa.
With reference to the United States and China, all of us are familiar with the trade disputes that there have been. One of them would be with respect to Huawei, which is a company that telecoms companies in South Africa do have relations with in terms of both chips production and components. So the view that if there's a conflict with China, everybody else must join in is a very worrying one. And of course, China and the United States of America are the two largest economies of the world. And when they're trading together in a stable manner, all of us are able to have our economies stable. But once there's a rift, we are all affected because they're so big.
Well, to discuss the U.S.-China face-off in Africa, we have contacted Chindo Shu, a senior fellow, a Pangol Institution and political analyst. Thanks for your time today. Now, why have most African countries embraced ties with China despite warnings from Western neocolonial powers to keep off Beijing?
Well, this is a good question, actually. You know, a lot of Western scholars or commentators, the politicians, they don't really understand the nature of China-African relationship. You know, it goes back to the 1950s or even earlier. There's a Chinese support to African movement of national independence from colonial rules, you know, from Western countries. And there's also African support to the new China, so-called, which was founded in 1949, the People's Republic of China, to return to the UN and regain its legitimate seat at the UN and also at the UN Security Council as one of the permanent members of the UN Security Council. So in China, you know, we were taught since very young, you know, we owe a debt to African countries for their support, diplomatic support to the new China and to the regain of the international status within the UN system.
China is the leading manufacturer of lithium-ion batteries in the world. The United States is also very much in the race for lithium deposits in Africa in a bid to overtake China, which has gone a step further by establishing lithium processing plants in countries like Zimbabwe. This is in line with policies of African countries that now want to add value to their minerals instead of exporting raw or unprocessed natural resources. The U.S. appears intent on confronting China and stopping the country's development projects in Africa.
I think, you know, the U.S. policy on Africa is not really about their relationship with Africa. Their priority is to take on China or Russia. And they think the Chinese presence in the African continent is too large or too strong for them to accept. In that sense, they take African continent or African countries somehow as their vassal states, you know, they should serve the interests of the Washington instead of working for themselves. This is, you know, in a sense, the mentality, a colonial mentality. Somehow they don't respect the sovereignty, the sovereign ability to make decisions based on their own national interests of African countries. The U.S., in the second sense, they are more or less is forcing African countries to pick side between China, Russia, and on the other side, Washington.
China's foreign minister, Qin Gang, recently visited the African Union and said Africa needs solidarity and cooperation rather than confrontation. He pointed out that no country or individual has the power to force African countries to pick sides. Africa should be a stage for international cooperation and not an arena for major force rivalry. On the other hand, U.S. Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin warned African leaders at a summit that China and Russia risked destabilizing the continent. Now, it's quite clear that unlike China, the U.S. is hostile and confrontational in its approach in Africa. Do you agree?
I think, you know, if you look at the U.S. overall policy on Africa, their policy or their priority is to take on China, is to overcompete China instead of doing business on equal footing with African countries, which is what China is doing. From Chinese perspective, it's really about the business, you know, Chinese investment, you know, in countries and regions where China sees fit, which usually is a win-win situation. You know, China will benefit from such a deal, and such a deal will benefit the regional countries. Because if you don't do that, if you don't follow this win-win policy or win-win principle, and your trade and investment won't be sustainable, because people will see if you benefit from such a deal and I'm losing, and then they will discontinue the operation or the cooperation with you. So it's that simple.
Well, the so-called China's debt trap in Africa is a narrative trap imposed on China and Africa by Western powers. China says its projects in Africa have contributed to Africa's development and the improvement of people's lives. An African expert speaks here on the debt trap propaganda.
The debt trap issue has always been a political, it has always been a political slander. A third of African debt is owed to asset managers, private banks, and all that. But interestingly, the West has loudmouthed. The monopoly of global media means they could shout from the rooftops and get everybody listening.
U.S. Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen, in a recent visit to Africa, once again repeated claims by Western officials that China is creating a debt problem in the continent.
First of all, there's a debt issue. I think, you know, the international community acknowledged that. That includes the U.S. and that includes China. All countries acknowledge, you know, there's a debt issue with the developing countries. In some situation, it's a serious issue. So if we go, you know, into detail about the problems, about, you know, what are the causes for this debt problem, the U.S. policy is absolutely one of them. Instead of blaming China, and the U.S. probably should take a careful look at their own policies, including their role on the Ukraine war, and also their, you know, biting sanctions on Russia, and also their constant raise of interest rates. And lastly, I would add that, you know, U.S. is not really in a position to talk about the debt problem of other countries, because they have a much larger debt problem, and which is looming. They are asking the Congress to increase the ceiling, so-called ceiling, basically, so that it will allow them to borrow more from countries like China, like Japan.
Late last year, 49 out of the 55 member state African Union were invited to Washington to attend the U.S.-Africa Leaders Summit. While African countries need support to fill the deficit caused by various challenges, including the impacts of the COVID-19 pandemic, African experts insist that Africa wants ties based on mutual respect and not the Big Brother influence projected by Washington.
Last year's U.S.-Africa summit was cited as an example of Washington trying to catch up with Beijing in Africa. Now, did Biden succeed in his objective during the summit?
their purpose of developing relationship with African countries is not really about their bilateral relationship. It's only because they see, oh, China is developing relationship with African countries rapidly, or China's presence in African countries is strong, China's trade with African countries is the largest, and the Chinese investment in African countries is the largest. So there's a sense of urgency. Oh, we need to do something to keep down the Chinese development, or to create some setback probably on China's relationship with African countries. That's why they see the necessity of dealing with African countries, of having this such like summit. I would say itself, not, you know, it's not for the African countries, is not for bilateral relationship. It's all for competition with China or confrontation with China.
Well, some analysts believe that African countries could use the ongoing rivalry between the United States and China to advance their own interests. Now, what should African leaders do to ensure that the interests of the continent are secured?
Yes, good question again. I think for African countries, it's really about to remain independent, to remain sovereign in terms of making decisions, always starting from their own national interests when they deal with powers, you know, big powers in particular, like the US, EU, China, Russia, etc. And also, you know, don't be pressured by Washington or Brussels into submission and to make policies to serve the interests of Washington or Brussels instead of their own interests. That's a key point. That is, you know, when they deal with other countries, they deal with on equal terms. And the I would say there's it's justifiable for them to demand equality and also respect and a mutual benefit from other countries. And secondly, I think, you know, very important is related to the first point. That is, they should not be used as tools in this geopolitical game against certain countries like China and Russia.
Very well put there. African countries must reject being used as geopolitical tools by Western powers against countries such as China and Russia. I would like to thank our guest, Chindo Shu, a senior fellow at the Pangol Institution. Let's now take a short break before our next topic, which is on how the military regime in Sudan has betrayed the masses in this country by normalizing ties with the Israeli regime. Stay with us.
Betrayal in Sudan.
You're listening to Africa Today. Africa Today is an analytical weekly review of political, economic, and social events in Africa, the world's second largest continent. The series is broadcast every week on Saturdays and Sundays by IRIB English Radio.
The military regime in Sudan, led by General Abdel Fattah al-Burhan, has moved to finalize a deal normalizing ties with the Israeli regime. Now, this comes after Israeli regime's foreign minister Eli Cohen visited Sudan early February, where he met General al-Burhan.
The people of Sudan have traditionally supported the liberation of Palestine and therefore reject any normalization deal with the Israeli apartheid regime, which is occupying Palestine and continues to commit atrocities and war crimes against Palestinians.
To discuss how the Sudanese military regime has betrayed its people and Palestinians by normalizing ties with the Israeli regime, we have contacted Elijah Magnia. He's a journalist and political analyst. Thanks for your time, sir, today. Now, do you think Sudan's military leader, Abdel Fattah al-Burhan, depends on U.S. and Israeli support to remain in power, and this situation has compelled him to normalize ties with the Israeli regime?
I think al-Burhan, the Sudanese provisional leaders of Sudan today, is really looking forward to remain in power and not to pass on the authority to a civilian government. And for that, he needs an international recognition. And more specifically, he needs a Western and an Arab recognition. So by approaching Israel, he is building a good connection with the Israelis. He's earning the support of the Americans. And Israel has already good connection with the Emiratis, with the Bahraini, and also with Saudi Arabia. So in making this move, he creates good relationship with the Arab because he needs their money, and with the Americans because he doesn't want them to attack him and call for a regime change in Sudan. And this is why I think he's going to officially normalize with Sudan, even if the population disagree with him.
Sudanese protesters have staged rallies to express their outrage and reject the North African country's decision to move forward with normalization of ties with the Israeli regime. The al-Burhan regime is ignoring demands of the masses that have for decades supported the liberation of Palestine.
Sudan is not alone in this. We have seen during the Qatar World Cup how all the Muslims and Arab citizens that came to Qatar refused any contact with the Israelis. So it is not only Sudan the Sudanese leadership that has a big gap between the leadership and the population. All the Arab countries who normalize with Israel ignored the will of the population.
The masses in Sudan have been holding various protests against the regime in Khartoum over the U.S. and Israeli-backed al-Burhan military regime.
When we take to the streets every day and people die every day, it's not for nothing. It's for change. It's for a civilian government, a democratic government that protects the rights of people. It is our right to protest. The military will not rule us. This country is supposed to be a civilian democratic country.
Can the anti-Israeli protests and the anti-dictatorship protests turn into a major movement to topple the al-Burhan regime?
Well, we haven't seen a major protest in Sudan enough to turn the or to create a danger to al-Burhan's leadership, because he had the army on his side. Because he has all the different parts of the army protecting him, this is why the civilian population is not capable of standing against the army until now, unless there is something major that's happening in Sudan.
Sudan is a strategic country in the region. There is concern that the Israeli apartheid regime will use this country to infiltrate African countries and further meddle and spread instability across the region.
Of course, the Israelis have been established in the African continent since 1960s, and they had a good relationship with over 30 countries. However, after the behavior of the Israelis in the exodus of the Palestinians, most African countries, particularly the Muslim countries, cut their relationship with Israel. And now Israel is starting to return to Africa and is using its relationship with Egypt, with the Arab world, particularly with the Emiratis that are also present in Africa, and by expanding slowly to Sudan, having leaking that it has good relationship with Saudi Arabia, to convince the African country to regain the relationship with Israel as it was in the 60s.
Chad, like its neighbor Sudan, is ruled by a military dictatorship and has also normalized ties with the Israeli apartheid regime. Now, first, do you think Israel has a role in suppressing democracy in Chad, just like it's doing in Sudan?
Indeed, Chad is a very important country for Israel. Maintaining good relationship with Chad, particularly after the new president seized the power, is very important for Israel. And the Israelis are supporting the Chad president in technology, intelligence, and with all the equipment needed for the president of Chad and the power in Chad, the militaries, to consolidate their strengths over the population. This is why Israel is telling the authority in Chad that it has a lot to offer for them, and the military are accepting it.
Chad is also rich in minerals such as uranium. The Israeli regime is believed to be infiltrating this country to plunder its minerals and especially uranium for its nuclear weapons program.
Well, that's a good point. Chad is not only rich in uranium, but it is rich in gold, in diamond, and so many other minerals. This is why Israel is interested in Chad, because it is on the border with Libya and on the border with Egypt, with Sudan, with Niger, with Nigeria. It is also a presence for the Israeli to expand to all of Africa.
Israeli weapons are being used to further inflame civil wars in Africa. A report issued by a panel of experts appointed by the UN Security Council to study the civil war in South Sudan says weapons manufactured by Israel Weapon Industries have been used by warring parties in this East African country.
Is the Israeli apartheid regime really concerned about the stability of African countries, especially considering the fact that its weapons have been used to inflame civil wars in the continent?
Israel is not concerned about the stability of Africa. Israel is concerned about being present in Africa. Israel can see how the Russians, the Chinese, the Egyptians, the Turks are in Africa, particularly in Chad and in other countries. It has excellent relationship with Nigeria. It's trying to improve the relationship with Niger. This is why the Israelis are present in Africa more than ever, because there is a lot of wealth and minerals and natural resources in Africa. So it is not about the stability of Africa, because in both cases, stability or instability, the Israelis always profit from being present there, particularly when they are part and instigator of the instability in any country they establish themselves in.
There you have it. The Israeli apartheid regime does not care about the stability of Africa, and it's actually infiltrating the continent to plunder its resources. I'd like to thank our guest, Elijah Magnia, for his insight today. And that brings us to the end of this week's edition of Africa Today. It's been great having you. Goodbye for now.
You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1920 to 2020 UTC on the following frequencies. Shortwave 49 meters, 6,040 kilohertz for Europe, and 25 meters, 11,880 kilohertz for Southern Africa, and FM 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or Bat 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.ir/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.